darkness is not an affirmative force. It simply reoccupies the space vacated by the light.
This is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio.
And Urban Family Talk.
It should be uncomfortable for a believer to live as a hypocrite.
Delivering people out of the bondage of mainstream media.
And the philosophies of this world.
God has called you and me to be his ambassadors. Even in this dark moment. Let's not miss our moment.
And now, the Hamilton Corner.
Good evening. Welcome to this almost to your weekend. Get your weekend started edition of the Hamilton Corner. Back in my hometown, I used to have a saying, it's the weekend, baby. I'm so glad you're joining us today. You're making your way, most of you, many of you are making your way from your part-time jobs to your full-time jobs. Fellas, I'm going to let you in on a secret. Come real, real close now. Sunday is Mother's Day. Don't forget, Sunday is Mother's Day. Please don't forget about your wives and your mothers and even your daughters who may be mothers. Sunday is Mother's Day. Now, you don't have to tell them you heard that in the corner. You can just show up as if you remembered all on your own. No problem. That was free of charge. Absolutely, we must celebrate our mothers this weekend, the women in our lives who have been the vessels that God has allowed us to be related to, that aid us. And I say it all the time that some people forget that marriage is ministry, parenthood is ministry, and that the Lord has given the immediate families, the nuclear families, the internal capacity to be proponents and executors of the Great Commission. How often do we neglect that when the Lord has given us right within our own family units the capacity to make disciples? Never forget in Acts chapter 1, Jesus explained, and this is Jesus in full resurrected form, where he says that the way that this is done is in Jerusalem and Samaria and the uttermost parts of the world. We want to make sure that we're not in such an as such a commitment to win the world that we neglect Jerusalem. If you follow the lives of many of Christian leaders all throughout history, that you've heard many of them say that if I could do it all over again, I would spend more time and focus more energy at home. And I say all the time that I don't want to be a public success and a private failure, to where the Lord has been instrumental in operating through me as a vessel to serve the world while I neglect my family. No, sir, not on my watch. My first ministry is to my wife. I tell my children all the time, mommy's first. I know sometimes we think we need to serve our children first. Mm-mm. It's my job as the husband and father of my home to make sure my children know that my wife is first. One of the best things you can do to serve your children and train your children is to show them what it looks like to love your wife. And then after mommy is taken care of, then I take care of the children. Because newsflash, as wonderful, huggable, snuggable as they are, as beautiful and as wonderful as they are, they're going to be gone pretty soon. And guess what? Once my children are out of the house, guess who's going to be left there? Mommy and me. That's exactly right. So let's take care of the mothers in our lives this weekend and make sure they know, not merely by verbal declaration, but they know by action that they are cherished, that they are prized, and that they are loved. Well, praise God. I got to tell you, I'm fired up today. We're going to begin in the epistle of James, chapter 4, verses 1 through 7. And I just want to say this. I want to encourage every listener, if you are a believer and you recognize that the Lord has given us his holy word, his holy writ, to be boldly biblical. Not to be, you know, mamby-pamby, squeamishly biblical. Be boldly biblical. We have the unflinching word of God. And so we can be bold with God's word. In fact, in Proverbs, it says that the righteous are bold as lions. We don't have to be casualties of our culture, but that we can set the tone and the temperature in this culture if we are willing to be boldly biblical. Boldly biblical. Praise God. Well, as I stated, we're going to begin in the epistle of James. And just so everyone can be mindful of this, the epistle of James was written by Jesus's you could say half brother, but really more than half if you're tracing genealogies. But Jesus's brother James was raised in the household of Joseph and Mary, and James was one of Jesus's disciples who did not become a convert until after Jesus's resurrection. James is one of the ones where Jesus said that a prophet is without honor in his own hometown. Because, of course, you can see it while the world is saying the Messiah, Messiah. James is like, who? Jesus? The dude who didn't want to feed the dog? the dude who every time mommy and daddy said put out the trash, he was always doing the right thing. I mean, of course, that familiarity with him was an impediment to him recognizing and seeing him for who he truly was. But after the resurrection, hey, after the resurrection, he was able to declare thou art the Lord and the Christ. And this is who is writing this epistle. James was the early leader in the church in Jerusalem. Prior to Peter's ascent to leading the church at Jerusalem, James was the leader in the church at Jerusalem, even though Peter was one who preached on the day of Pentecost. But this is the apostle James. And look what he says here. I'll read all the scriptures and I'll go through and make some comments. And the main thing I want to focus on actually is in the first couple of verses. But the scripture is so rich. There's so much here for us to delve into. But here we go. It says verse 1 in chapter 4. James chapter 4, verses 1 through 7. It says this. What causes quarrels? And let me say this. I use the ESV, the English Standard Version of the Bible, in case you're wondering. I find it to be one of the most true combinations of authentic adherence to the original languages while simultaneously conversing in conversational English language. All right? But here we go. Verse 1. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. And when you ask and do not receive, it is because you ask wrongly. The King James says, ask amiss, to spend it on your passions. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you suppose it is to no purpose that the scripture says he yearns jealously over the spirit that he has made to dwell within us? But he gives more grace. Therefore, it says God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. All right. Now, as I stated earlier, I really want to focus on the first verse in chapter 4. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? It's a common phenomenon, and actually, Israel Wayne, who is a pretty well-known homeschool conference speaker, did a wonderful presentation on this on the last homeschool conference my wife and I went to at the Teach Them Diligently conference in Nashville, which I highly recommend if you are inquisitive about homeschooling. It's a great place where you can get some information to get started. TeachThemDiligently.net is the website for it. But so often we have conversations and we very easily say, I'll use Jeff for an example. Of course, this is just a hypothetical example because I'm telling you, Jeff is a rose of a brother. Okay. But what if I came to you and I said, man, you know what? I don't know if I'm going to have a good show today because Jeff just made me mad. Have you ever had a statement like that? Have you ever said, man, I would be able to do this, but so-and-so just makes me so angry. They make me so mad. Or within a parental context, you know, I can't believe little Johnny, little Julie did that. They just make me so upset. It's a common statement that's often made, right? Well, James, oh man, I'm going to tell you guys, when this hit me, it hit me like a ton of bricks. James is writing and he asks the question, well, what causes quarrels What causes fights among you? James is asking the question. And remember I said earlier about being boldly biblical. That's what we're going to do. We're going to be boldly biblical. The reality is, ladies and gentlemen, that no one can really make you mad. Now, what do you mean, Abraham? I'll explain it very simply. There may be certain conduct, certain verbiage, certain words, certain activities that could serve as a stimulus for you and I to emote in such a way that would not be glorifying to God. But the reality is, for us to emote or to act in a way that is not glorifying to God, no one or nothing externally can compel us to do so. Jeff can say something that I don't like, but Jeff's statement does not in and of itself compel me to act out or to respond in anger. In order for me to do that, I have to willingly and voluntarily yield my mind, my heart, my emotions, my members to the suggestion that Jeff may make. James says, what causes quarrels? What causes fights among you? Is it not this? Your passions at war within you. I'm going to say a statement. There was a guy in college who said this to me one time. He said, Abe, you know, I love you and there's nothing you can do about it. Man, and I pondered that. What this brother was really saying to me is that his love for me was so great, there was nothing that I could do to compel him to not love me. But then our marriages, I told my wife, babe, I love you and there's nothing you can do about it. If my wife does something that I don't like, that doesn't compel me to not love her. Oh, man, doesn't the Bible cut right to the quick? The reality is, folks, for us to act out in anger, for us to emote angrily, it requires us to willingly and voluntarily do it. And so the reality is, if there are certain stimuli in our lives and they are consistent, habitual, and maybe pattern stimuli that provokes in us an angry response or provokes in us an angry emotion or action, the reality is we have to voluntarily agree to do so. So the facts are, when we recognize those stimuli as presented to us, they really are revealing to us an opportunity and an area in our lives where we need additional sanctification, additional growth. When Israel Wang was presenting this information, he talked about how in the King James Bible, because it was known that King James had an anger problem. And so in many of the translations, King James kind of added some things that weren't in the original manuscripts to allow him to be sinfully angry at certain points. That was fascinating to me. So the simple encouragement here, and I know I read 7 verses, but really the first verse is what I want to focus on, is are you a person who is prone to get angry? Prone to act out in anger, prone to be driven by an angry emotion. We may think that it's based on something that's happened external to us, but the reality is, as James lays it out in chapter 4, verse 1, quarrelings and fighting come from the passions at war within us. So if we recognize that we're prone to those things, what God really is showing us that we have an additional growth area where we can now come to the Lord and say, Lord, help me. Father, would you build me, fortify me to such a degree where I will resist the invitations to allow the sinfulness of anger to grip me and cause me to either emote or to act, but to where I can stand in a position where there's nothing you can do to make me act contrary to who I am.
Shining light into the darkness. This is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio
and Urban Family Talk.
Welcome back to the Hamilton Corner here on American Family Radio and Urban Family Talk. I'm your host, Abraham Hamilton III, and I'm so excited to have back on the program. You've heard him here before, Vice President at the Media Research Center, Dan Gaynard. The Media Research Center is an institution, I would suggest to you, that focuses on keeping the talking snake media honest. They help us stay abreast of all of their evidences of biases and their willingness to be fast and loose with the truth in order to accomplish their craven political agenda, and I would say even social influence agenda. Dan, thank you for joining me here today on the Hamilton Corner. I look forward to this interview and so glad that we were able to finally get you back on to the Hamilton Corner.
Oh, well, I'm very happy to be back on. I love being on with you all, and there's so much going on. The media, you almost wonder if, well, we're an institution, maybe they belong in one.
I like it, Dan. I like it. I like it. All right. Well, we'll start with Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg, the sultan of his own community, which I said, you see how you see it? The community, the community. Well, Facebook has come out with newly published information about their community standards about which will guide what content is allowed and what is prohibited. Dan, the question I have for you is, should the American populace as a whole and should conservatives and Christians be concerned about Facebook's new community standards?
Well, yeah, and they actually have been not just concerned about the new ones. They've been using them for a while. They've just been behind closed doors, so we didn't know what we were being held to. I credit them for transparency, because that's one of the things that we've called for. But the idea that if you look, particularly in the hate speech section, one of the things it talks about limiting is sort of moral commentary. You're not supposed to criticize people based on morality. Mm. And so, I mean, that's sort of the essence of being a social conservative. You look at somebody, I think it was Will Chamberlain, who famously said he had slept with 20,000 women or something like that. I'm not supposed to be able to criticize that.
Right.
At the same time, it raises issues about conservative groups that are critical of gay marriage and supporting traditional marriage. Mm-hmm. Are we able to do that? It's very unclear, and I think probably kept deliberately vague. Mm. And then you even go further, and they say one of the protected groups are immigrants. Mm. So you're allowed, according to these standards, to criticize immigration policy, but not immigrants. And one of the words they specifically forbid is free rider.
Mm.
So under this definition, the very idea of someone coming across the border illegally and applying that day for benefits. So this person has literally never contributed one penny to the U.S. economy, to our nation, or anything, and then they want benefits. There's a very definition of free rider, but we can't call them that. So what happened was the MRC, my boss, Brent Bozell, asked me to do digging on this issue months back now, and we released a big report on it called Censorship. Mm-hmm. And the idea, what we looked at the Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google, and those are the top social media companies.
Mm-hmm.
What we did, we looked at all the conservative claims, and yes, conservatives are being mistreated in that world.
Absolutely.
So then 63 top conservatives, Brent, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, who's heading up our censorship effort, and 61 other conservative leaders, including, Wildman from American Family Association.
Yeah, we're involved in it, yeah.
Tony Perkins and Representative Lamar Smith, who heads the Media Fairness Caucus, et cetera, got involved in this effort. And what they did was they called for the social media companies to do four broad brush things. And they're really big, and one of the things they're asking for, though, was increased transparency about what they do, for who they censor and who they don't, more clarity about what hate speech means and how that affects people, an equal seat at the table. Mm-hmm. To use an example, Twitter has 25 members of its Trust and Safety Council in the U.S. 12 of them are liberal, only one's conservative. So the conservative groups want an equal seat at the table. And the last thing they pointed out is, people need to understand, we don't have a right to be on Facebook or Twitter.
That's right. It's a private company.
There's no constitutional right for that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is firmly established law about free speech.
Mm-hmm.
And these conservative leaders were calling for the social media companies to embrace those principles of free speech in this country, so that we're not using the guide of, let's say, someplace like China or someplace that believes in restrictive speech. We should be using these guides. We spent hundreds of years coming up with the guides about what we're allowed in free speech, and now we're starting over.
Yeah, I mean, go figure. If you love the liberty that America offers, why not employ that same liberty standard in the operation of your private company? You know, it's just baffling to me. And I found that interesting because in their guidelines, they have three tiers to determine the level of hate. And as you pointed out earlier, in tier two, they cite vocalizing a dislike of a certain group of people who are given protected status by Facebook, not protected status by the federal laws that we have in our country, but Facebook's own subjective standards of what a protected group or a protected class may be. And I just find that utterly problematic. And I think you rightly point out the fact that there is no constitutional right to access to Facebook, but it would be nice if they would just come right out and say, listen, we're not going to allow certain things to be said on our platform. And that way, the American people could have the information they need to make their decision as to whether or not they want to continue to engage in the social media sphere using Facebook or whatever particular platform it may be. Is that...
Go ahead. So that's some of what they're doing, but we're pushing back because, you know, when you look at the four groups that we targeted, we've targeted Facebook, which has 2.2 billion people on its platform.
That's with a B, not an M. Billion.
Yeah, right. So number one social media platform in the world. Google, which is the number one search platform. Mm-hmm. It's a video site. YouTube, which is the number one video platform in the world. Mm-hmm. And then Twitter, which has become the number one newswire for reporters, for politicians, and for think tank people in the civilized world. So without just those four, if you excise those four, the conservative movement is essentially shut down online. So that's why we're pushing back and saying, well, no, these guidelines that you've got, they don't work.
Wow. Now, just recently, and I reported on this here in the Hamilton Corner, Mark Zuckerberg was at a meeting literally titled Off the Record. Literally was titled Off the Record. Well, you have the usual suspects of progressive media, Huffington Post, the New York Times, et cetera, CNN, all of these guys, they're gathered. And at this meeting, Mark Zuckerberg is giving an interview where he basically reveals that if you think that our efforts at Facebook to suppress conservative speech have been effective so far, of course, he didn't use those words. The communication basically, though, is you ain't seen nothing yet, because he expressly said that they are going to dial up the intensity. Now, that is an exact quote, to dial up the intensity to suppress unwelcomed content on the platform. How much more can it be dialed up from where they already are, Dan?
Well, what they've done is they've already downgraded news on the platform, and they had set everybody's online experiences are different because we all have different friends, we all have different likes and interests, and so the AI that interacts with us interprets it differently. But it was set up so that for everyone's news feed on Facebook, you got 5% of news sites. Mm. Well, now they've downgraded it to 4, and they've ramped up which ones get chosen. Now, Zuckerberg personally said, you know, they think that the Wall Street Journal and New York Times are trustworthy news outlets. Well, that's, again, disturbing because a lot of conservatives don't view the New York Times as a trustworthy news outlet.
Yeah. I have a story right in my stack here to talk about with you. Just this week, the New York Times kind of had an egg on the face kind of moment. Because they sought to zero in on Mike Pompeo and to criticize him for being absent from Washington while President Trump is announcing the withdrawal of the U.S. from the debacle that was, or that is, the Iran deal. And it turns out that Mike Pompeo was doing something pretty important. Would you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, here's the New York Times headline. At a key moment, Trump's top diplomat is again thousands of miles away. You know, how apocalyptic, he's thousands of miles away. But it turns out he was negotiating with the nuclear power that's also got weapons of mass destruction of chemical and biological weapons that we're trying to keep from anybody going to war with. Oh, by the way, they also have been holding three Americans hostage, and so he was able to get them released and bring them back in the middle of the night. And so talk about... I mean, if a newspaper could have egg on his face, today, you know, certainly New York Times today.
And this is the hallowed institution of journalistic integrity that Mark Zuckerberg says, yeah, we find them to be a reliable news source. And yeah,
but,
so when it comes to news.
I will say about Zuckerberg, there was another article, USA Today had an article about him. He was talking about the pushback that they got when he went on Capitol Hill. And the pushback was really strong. Members of Congress, Ted Cruz, Steve Scalise, Ben Sasse, and others really talked heavily about the bias against conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was caught off guard by this. He went there to talk about data integrity, and they're hitting him with bias against the right. So they have engaged former Republican Senator John Kyle, Republican from Arizona, and they have engaged him to do an analysis. And if they do a legitimate analysis, they'll discover they've got a legitimate problem.
I hope
that they will do so.
Now that brings to mind a question for me. Well, should conservatives be optimistic about what's going to come out from that? Because didn't they have this kumbaya with conservatives in the past with Glenn Beck and other people all gathered with Mark Zuckerberg and to discuss the bias specifically from Facebook against conservatives?
Well, they had, what you're referring to is a meeting when it came out in 2016 during the campaign, two key things came out. One of them was that at a public meeting in Facebook, some employees were asking the bosses, hey, shouldn't we get involved and try to basically set the election up so Hillary will beat Trump?
Mm.
They were told no. So, I mean, that's a good thing. But then Gizmodo reported that Facebook was spinning its news feed and in a way that was hurting conservatives and also jamming things into the news feed that were not legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, Mark Zuckerberg met with a bunch of people, including my boss, Brent Bozell,
mm-hmm.
and Glenn Beck, and a bunch of others. It was an attempt, it seemed, to open at least communication.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, so far, it seems like Facebook, of the various social media companies, seems the one that is trying to communicate most with the right. But Zuckerberg also pointed out when he testified on the Hill the problems, the headwinds they're facing. They hire from Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
They're hiring liberals. Then they've got these hate speech laws in there, and then they didn't mention this, but they also work with a lot of liberal groups.
Yeah.
And that's, after a certain point, you box things in, make it difficult. And the last thing they do, and all sorts of online sites do this, where they've set it up so that you can alert or somehow challenge a post that, oh, this is bad.
Yeah.
Well, the left has figured out how to activate its, I think, largely, activist base. I was going to come up with loser base, but that's people who sit at home in their basements who want to do stuff for the left, and they go on an alert on conservative content all over the place.
Mm.
And so that feeds into the AI, the artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. that all these sites use to manage. So we're sort of boxed in on the right. And it's my hope that this John Kyle thing and some comments from Zuckerberg indicate at least Facebook will be a little bit more open to hearing conservatives. Because honestly, when you look at those hate speech guidelines, it is obvious that Facebook didn't have conservatives at the table. Because conservatives would have never agreed to some of the things that they say.
I guess this may be the last question I can get to. You mentioned your organization, Media Research Center, creating a censorship document. Can our listeners get access to that document? And if so, how can they do that?
They can indeed. If you go online to newsbusters.org, you will see actually a pretty prominent banner ad at the top of the page in blue, censored. How online media companies are suppressing conservative speech. And all you got to do is click on that, and it takes you to a page where you're able to find out some more information, and you'll be able to download the report. And if you're really into it, there's 18,000 words there. If you're not really into it, download the report and just read the executive summary.
Good.
The executive summary gets to the heart of the problem and has some recommendations for moving forward for the tech companies.
Last question, since we got a little bit of time left. It seems like CNN's Jim Acosta is using Twitter to spew out what many perceive as to be a campaign ad for President Trump. What's he doing?
Well, because, see, Jim lives in a bubble, and he doesn't realize what he tweeted out this list of things that Trump had done, and he said Trump's trying to overturn everything that Obama did. And I want to tell him that's a feature, that's not a bug. That's what we voted for, man.
That is what many of the American people voted for. It's probably why we're saying President Trump right now instead of President, we won't say that name here right now. Dan, thank you so much for joining me today. Dan Gaynor, Vice President at the Media Research Center. His website is newsbusters.org, newsbusters.org, where you can see the censorship report as well as all the other great work that they are doing over there for us. Dan, thank you so much for coming on the program. We have to have you back, my man.
Anytime, man. You know I like being on with you.
The Hamilton Quarter podcast and one-minute commentaries are available at AFR.net and UrbanFamilyTalk.com. Back to the Hamilton Quarter on American Family Radio
and Urban Family Talk.
Welcome back to the Hamilton Corner here in American Family Radio and Urban Family Talk. Man, this time flies by. I have to let you know something else that is happening that it is pretty troubling thought all across the country. Just last week, the state of Connecticut became the 11th state or district, including the District of Columbia, to join this national popular vote movement. So the state of Connecticut, what they have done, they have now passed legislation in their General Assembly that has passed their Senate, and their governor, Daniel Malloy, has signed it into law to where the state of Connecticut has basically decided to ignore the will of its constituency in a presidential election. Now, what am I talking about? The state of Connecticut has agreed, their legislators have passed legislation, and their governor has signed into law that their electoral votes will be distributed to whomever, and this is in presidential elections, will be allotted to whomever wins the national popular vote. Regardless of who the Connecticut people voted for. So the reality is, let's say hypothetically, if the citizens of Connecticut vote for a Republican presidential candidate, but the national popular vote was won by the Democratic candidate, the electoral votes for the state of Connecticut would be allotted to that Democrat presidential candidate. And they have become, Connecticut has become now the 11th state and or jurisdiction, because it really is 10 states and the District of Columbia, have all agreed in a compact to pool their electoral votes and pledge them to the popular vote winner. Of course, you can probably imagine that the people who are advocating for this all across the country are your usual gathering of regressives. They are all states that have been dominated by Democrat politicians in recent history. And those states include Hawaii, Illinois, California, with its 55 electoral votes, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington State, Washington, D.C., and now the state of Connecticut. Now, this is amazing, and this is, again, one of those teachable moments where when we fail to communicate to generations as well as to leaders the wisdom and the rationale of the founding fathers, we see things like this happening. I'd like to remind you that when the United States of America was formed under the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, our founders had the opportunity to establish any form of government they sought to do so. They could have repeated a monarchy in the U.S. just like they had in England, but they expressly rejected that. They also investigated as to whether or not the U.S. should be formed as an absolute democracy. And they rejected that as well. This is why you hear me say consistently and repeatedly that the United States of America is a constitutional republic. Of course, we have democratic features, but the government form and type is a constitutional republic. And I'll explain a little bit about what a constitutional republic is as opposed to an absolute democracy in a moment. But the founders expressly rejected the notion of an absolute democracy, saying that an absolute democracy is nothing more than a mobocracy. They opined, having escaped the tyrannical rule of a monarch, why would they then subject themselves to the tyranny of the 51%? You see, in a constitutional republic with democratic features, you of course use and employ the will of the people in various votes. However, there is an objective standard of law that is set in place based upon the whimsical nature of humanity. Because humans are often fickle, the founders determined that it would be most prudent to establish an objective, overarching set of legal principles, which is why the United States of America is known to be a government of laws and not of men. Why did they do this? They expressly refer to Jeremiah chapter 17:9 when saying that the heart of man is desperately wicked. Because of the inborn, inbred sin nature of man, the founders, I would suggest under the unction and leading of the Spirit of God, created a form of government that took into consideration, what do we do then when the fickle nature of mankind would seek to then declassify as something God would refer to as a criminal offense as no longer being criminal? What do we do then? What do we say then if man with his fickle and fleeting nature decides, you know what? We will now say murder is no longer murder. You know, kind of like killing babies. What do we do if man says murder is no longer murder? The founder said, well, we have something set in place for the fickle nature of mankind. It's called the Constitution. So that when, not if, when the fickle nature of mankind is exhibited, we have a neutral and objective set and system of laws in place that would rein in the fickle nature of mankind. Folks, one of the features of America being a constitutional republic, as opposed to being an absolute democracy subjected to the tyranny of the 51%, is the Electoral College system. The Electoral College system was promulgated to require the Commander-in-Chief, the President of the United States of America, to obtain support from a cross-section of the American populace. And not just to obtain a simple majority of the American populace. To say it differently, that there has to be a combination of supporters for the president from populous states as well as not so populous states. The Electoral College awards to each state in our union, including the District of Columbia, electoral votes for each representative in the Congress, which is based on the population of those states. Okay, and then the population of those states having electoral votes is then buttressed against each state also being allotted two electoral votes for each senator that is represented by the states. And each state in the union has two electoral votes, which means in order for any candidate for the presidency to be elected president, they have to get at least 270 electoral votes to win the office. Because the reality is, folks, if the nation were to go to a strict popular vote system, then candidates would only have to campaign in about six states. For example, California has 55 electoral votes. Florida has 29 electoral votes. New York has 29 electoral votes. Pennsylvania has 20. Illinois has 20. Ohio has 18. The reality is, folks, you could have a person to win the presidency with not even stepping foot into 40 plus states in the union. But with the Electoral College system, every state becomes critical. And again, it's not surprising to me that the states that all of them, every single state thus far who has submitted themselves to this national popular vote movement are all states that have been dominated by Democrats and were all won by Hillary Clinton in 2016. And the reality is, you hear the popular refrain, Hillary Clinton won the national popular vote by 3 million voters, folks. That entire difference in the quantity of voters comes from one state, California. But when you look at the number of states and seeing the cross-section of types of voters, for example, when you see states like Utah and Texas that were won by President Donald Trump, and then you combine that with states like Florida and then Virginia and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin, you see that there are completely different types of American people all across the country, that there must be a coalition of supporters in order for those states' electoral votes to go to President Donald Trump. I will remind you in this moment that states like Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, North Carolina, these states all were won by former President Barack Obama when he was elected president. But because of the appeal of President Trump and his resonance with these voters, that they flipped their allegiances. But if the national popular vote had been in place, you would have had Hillary Clinton winning the presidential election, even though she would have lost all of these states. With the Electoral College system, in order to win the election, you have to have at a minimum 20 some odd states to win the presidency. And the only reason and the only way these types of movements like the national popular vote movement can gain traction is if people do not, one, understand the Electoral College system, and two, they do not understand the wisdom of requiring the leader of our nation to gather a cross-section of support from different types of voters, from different types of places in order to win the presidency, as opposed to our national elections basically becoming coastal affairs. Now, fortunately, so far, the number of Electoral College votes in order for this to take root, so far with these 10 states and the District of Columbia, their total, and that's including Connecticut in that number, the total of Electoral College votes that are represented by those states is only 172. So in order for this actually to take effect, there would have to be enough states that would represent combined 270 electoral votes. But folks, that's less than 100 electoral votes away. So this is something we all need to be mindful of. And I'm encouraging you, and I mean, who wants to sit around at the dinner table at you know, holidays and say, hey, let's talk about the Electoral College? And of course, it's not the most scintillating topic of conversation. But it's high time we become reacquainted with our Constitution. Because the United States of America is the longest lasting constitutional republic with the liberty that we enjoy in the history of the world. There's a reason why the U.S. has risen to such prominence in such a short amount of time. Less than 300 years old as a nation, yet we have risen to literally leader of the free world. I wonder how that happened. Could it be that the principles of freedom that are enshrined in our Constitution are beneficial? That they actually help in creating the type of nation where people can, no matter where you come from, no matter where you're born, you could come from a broken family, a single parent home, and ascend to the ranks of President of the United States of America? We have got to get reacquainted with these ideas and these principles. I've heard it said before that the Electoral College system was created to help enforce slavery. I would point whoever would suggest that to the words of Frederick Douglass, who, by the way, was a slave himself, who said that I, too, believed that the Constitution was a pro-slavery document until I read it. Some people would point to the three-fifths clause of the Constitution as saying that it established a national value of men and women with skin color that looked like mine. That would be the furthest thing from the truth. Because the reality is that you had pro-slavery forces in the South fighting against anti-slavery forces in the North, and the pro-slavery forces in the South wanted to make sure that their slaves, which they viewed as chattel property, were counted in order to give them power in Congress. Remember what I said earlier, congressional representation is based on the population of the state. And so the Northerners said, well, okay, if you want your slaves to count for congressional representation, then you also have to allow your slaves to vote. The Southerners obviously balked at that suggestion. And so the compromise, now whether or not you agree with the compromise, that's a whole nother conversation, but the compromise had everything to do with power in Congress, not the value of a human being, because let me remind you as well that you had people of darker skin who were in the United States of America while the Constitution was being created who were free and they had darker skin. The Three-Fifths Clause had no bearing on them at all. But of course, we don't have those types of conversations because it didn't fit the popular narrative. You also have a popular narrative as if slavery is something that is unique to Europeans and it is unique to America, which is the furthest thing from the truth. People forget that the European slave traders actually learned and perfected the craft and learned to monetize slavery from Muslim slavers in Africa. That the transatlantic slave traders learned the trade of slavery from the trans-Saharan slave traders, which actually continued far after the transatlantic slave trade was abolished. We don't talk about that very much because we like to maintain narratives. And I'm just sharing all of this to help us understand why we should value the principles of freedom. We also don't have many conversations when you understand the long history of slavery in the world and how slavery predates the transatlantic slave trade, that there's only one worldview that actually fought to abolish slavery. And it's a biblical worldview that was advocated by and large by Europeans in Western civilization. We don't have many conversations about that. So what I'm saying is that we have to re-educate ourselves, reorient ourselves to the truth, and understand that the principles of freedom and liberty that our nation was founded upon is not only valuable, it's essential. Because can you tell me any other nation in the world where you have, for example, the history of slavery, and yet in such a short time period after the abolition of slavery, you have the leader of the free world to be a descendant of people with darker skin? Isn't that interesting? What I'm saying is that the United States of America is the greatest nation the world has ever seen. And it's worth fighting for. And the biblical worldview heritage, in spite of flawed men who did not live up to the principles perfectly, but the principles have allowed for the freedom in our nation to flourish, ultimately are worth upholding. Thank you for tuning into the program. Hope you have a great weekend.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.